By the way, when he comes in, he's in full camo. Camo shorts, camo vest over his t-shirt, camo hat. Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my regular co-host, Keith Boster from San Diego, California.
That's right. What's up, Jabber Jaws and Drone Strikes? See, that's a new thing I'm trying. That's what I'm going to call our fans, Jabber Jaws and Drone Strikes.
All right.
And with me is my co-host from Los Angeles, California, Cassidy Robinson.
Yes. We were saying the first time we tried to do this take that we needed more sound effects.
Yeah, and more production value in general. And then I compared us to some of, you know, the highest ranking podcasts out there and felt bad about myself. But then I actually feel bad because your little nugget of weird Buddha wisdom about us being like the best podcast that we can be. Mm-hmm. Is now lost to eternity. So
right. When I used to upload a long time ago, when they used to have all these different podcast directories, which they don't really do that anymore. But when I used to do that, I used to, they used to ask you stuff like, you know, give us a quick description of what your podcast is. And I never knew what to say because I didn't have my dumb little tagline yet. So I just said, it's like every other movie podcast, only dumber.
See, I like to think it's like every other movie review podcast, but funnier.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. That puts a lot of pressure on both of us.
I don't listen to any other movie review podcast, so fuck them. I'm the funniest one that I've heard.
It makes it really easy if you stay in a bubble.
Yeah. I recommend more people join me in the bubble.
I do too. And this week in the bubble, we're going to be reviewing Kong Skull Island and Dirty Mary Crazy Larry in our Netflix homework. Yeah. But so you were telling me before we started recording that you're a season pass holder at Disneyland?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. You know, it's funny because we were talking about that. I don't even remember why it came up. But the last time I was at Disneyland, not the last time, Ashley and I went in January. Mm-hmm. It was like right after Trump got elected, actually. And we went to the Conversations with Mr. Lincoln, which is arguably the weirdest attraction still at Disneyland.
I've never even heard of it. Was this at like the New Orleans Square or something?
It's right as you enter. It's right in the front. So it's like right off to the right as you enter. And it's this cool display as you enter it of like how Disneyland was when it first was built. It's kind of like this like weird historical document of Disneyland or this like weird Disneyland museum. Mm-hmm. There's like a fun little video that plays in the lobby with Steve Martin, how he talks about how he got his job at Disneyland.
Mm-hmm. Is he playing a banjo?
No, he started at the magic shop. Like, he used to work at the magic shop there.
Okay.
So, yeah, he just talks about how, you know, that he was working that job as a teenager before he got, you know, insanely famous. Mm-hmm. And then you go into this theater where they have this animatronic Lincoln. And it's really impressive. Like, it holds up well. And he just, like, kind of talks to you. And it was actually quite moving because of, I don't know if it was partially the timing that we went and saw. It was just like,
I'm going to say that probably had something to do with it.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, it was, just very moving and hopeful and optimistic. So, but, you know, that wasn't the story of my weekend. The real story of my weekend was the Comic-Con pre-registration opening up.
Yes, because you signed a contract with the Lucifer of conventions that you have to go every year.
Yeah, no, like literally, you have to go because then you get access to the pre-registration the next year, which is the your best odds of getting tickets. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I don't know if I read this or I heard it somewhere, but supposedly during regular registration, at this point, if you're just trying to get tickets from scratch, you have about a 5% chance of getting into their waiting room and getting tickets for like the full thing.
Yeah, that
just based on the number of people like logging in and trying to get tickets.
That's why I said a long time ago, fuck Comic-Con.
But if you have access to the pre-registration, you have about a 50-50 chance. And so between me and my wife and our friend who we've been going with for years now, between the three of us, usually one of us gets in and is able to get tickets for the other two. And this year I was lucky and I got in. And because Ashley had to work, so it was like I had to use her login and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally sold out 10 minutes after I got in and got our tickets.
Wow. What's even the point at that when it's that crazy? Like, you're literally limiting yourself. I mean, I guess they're filling capacity, so it's not like they're limiting their amount of people who can be there. You're just limiting, I guess, you're limiting the entire convention to people who know how to game a system.
It's not knowing how to game a system. It's like, you get preference for, you know, being dedicated enough to try to go year after year. Like, you know, these are the people who really care about Comic-Con. I do think it's a little unfortunate that it's not more open to people to discover Comic-Con. Because, you know, that used to be the case. But there are so many conventions nowadays.
Yeah, that I think overrides everything for me. Like, if Comic-Con was the only Comic-Con, if it was like it used to be where there was one in New York and one in San Diego once a year, then I could see the allure. But it's like living in Los Angeles, we have like four Comic-Con. Like,
same.
It's better than Comic-Con because you don't have to like sleep outside to go see people promote their bullshit television series that you're going to be able to see the same promotions online 15 minutes later.
You know, there was a point in time when I might have agreed with you, but that is part of the appeal.
Sleeping outside for watching people promote stuff.
The whole ordeal, there's something about being in Hall H, about suffering through that, about this weird shared experience with 6,000 other people, that you can feel. It's palpable.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't get that with the released footage online. You don't get that with and I get that not everyone gets it. And not everyone's going to enjoy that experience. But, to me, it's become part of the fun.
I guess. This is my experience every year with the news that trickles out from Hall H. I click online and go to comingsoon.com and I'm like, oh, they're going to do a new Deadpool series. Cool. And then that's it. This is a story that I wouldn't have thought about telling, but where I work, it's not an industry job, but it's in West LA, so there's a lot of rich people who live here. Every once in a while, we'll see somebody mildly famous. You know, like a D-level celebrity.
Sure.
Or maybe even like a C-level.
Okay.
And recently, of the last few months, Stone Cold Steve Austin has been a kind of regular.
What?
Not like a everyday regular, but I've seen him 3 or 4 times at our store.
Have you talked to him?
Yeah, I say, would you like a bag? And
he's like, you bet your ass. Give me a hell yeah, I want a bag.
No.
I don't care if I have to pay the extra 10 cents. I'll stone cold stun you for a bag.
Not exactly. I really wish, but no. So I do the LA thing, which is if you see somebody famous or you're helping them in a store or something, you just pretend like they're a normal person.
Yeah.
Because they get it all the time and blah, blah, blah.
Do you think he kind of wants it, though, at this point?
No, I think he had enough of it, like, during the height of his...
Here's your... Oh, it's $3.16? Well, there's Austin's $3.16!
So we're training this new girl, and she knows who it is, and she's freaking out. And she's like, oh my god, should I ask him for a picture? I'm like, no, don't. I just like, you know, because I'm also trying not to make a scene either, so I'm just like,
yeah,
calm down.
So, I mean, what would your advice be, like...
In that situation?
Do you think she would have been okay to say something like, I know who you are, and I'm a really big fan. And I don't want to make this weird, I just...
I would say the max of what would be acceptable. Like, before the job I was working, I was working an industry job, so I got really kind of desensitized to seeing famous people.
Ooh,
I know. Look at me. Yeah. Well, I lost that job, but anyway. But I'm kind of glad I kind of went through that because it did train me to, like, you know, they're just regular people and basically they don't want to be annoyed.
Yeah.
So but I would.
Don't you think that deep down they still, especially someone at like Stone Cold Steve Austin's level, don't you think they still, on some level,
you know what?
Appreciate?
I bet Stone Cold Steve Austin would appreciate it a lot more. There's a level, I'm sure. I'm sure it's like, you know, 5-year-old boys to like 12-year-old boys, he'd probably love it. Girls, particularly attractive ones, he's probably okay with it. And then people like me, like 30-something-year-old, like overweight, like nerdy guys, probably would rather never happen.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to say that is probably, and that's probably the case for most actors.
I don't think so. I think there is a line. I think there's a, like, you know, they don't want a scene. Mm-hmm. They don't want their day ruined. But I think that if they can get a, hey, you know, I watched you growing up and I really appreciate you. What your work means a lot to me. Like, if people could keep that, like,
sure,
respectable and chill,
yeah,
and not insane, I think that...
Yeah, they definitely don't want, a selfie or a picture or something like that.
That's a line.
Here's the issue, though, with even doing that, is that if it is a store and you're working at the store, and as a cashier especially, when they come through your line... They're going to be like, now there's like this familiarity. Like, is he going to like want to talk every time and make like a thing out of it?
Some people like that. Some people like familiarity at their stores. Not everyone.
Well, there's a difference between customer and patron familiarity, which I agree. Actually, I'm not super into that, but a lot of people are. And I will placate that if I have to. But when it comes to celebrity and fan familiarity, I think the less the better.
I would be appreciative.
Individual results may vary.
I guess so.
Let's talk about our movie news. We don't have a lot, and we've already talked a lot at the front of the show here. So let's get into this one that I posted a little bit ago. Apparently, they're doing a Matrix reboot. And the Wachowskis are not even going to be involved. Are you still there?
Yeah, can you not hear my fart noises? And I'm going for audible disdain.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was getting. It says, the idea of adapting The Matrix as a television series was nixed in recent months, but Warner Brothers sees a model in what Disney and Lucasfilm has done with Star Wars, exploring the hidden corners of the Matrix universe with movies such as Rogue One, Star Wars Story.
No, it's not the same.
Matrix Amoebaverse.
Can we not? I have The Matrix. It's good. It's fine. Mm. It's done.
They were really pushing it with the sequels, as it was.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, most people would have preferred that universe be a little bit smaller. I think most people were happy with just the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And once they sort of try to expand it, they're like, what's with this weird cave orgy? Like, that wasn't in the first one. Sweaty cave dancing.
Right.
I've signed up for the trench coats and the wall running.
Absolutely. You know, I kind of... You could kind of almost say that, like, the Wachowskis sort of explored this, like, multi-universe sort of thing. I mean, comic books have been doing it forever because that's how comic books work.
No, they didn't. They were sequels.
Well, no, but you remember there was the Animatrix, which were, like, okay, kind of expanded stories or whatever.
Well, no.
And there was the Matrix video game, which told the stories in between the sequels.
Ugh, yeah, and how, ugh, and, gross.
No, I know.
And Lost had a video game, too, that was like, oh, you can explore the island and not learn any of the secrets that we don't learn in the show.
Right.
No, I mean, if you want to get technical, Star Wars still beat them, because mm-hmm. they had the Ewok adventures, and they had the shitty Christmas special. Like,
right.
If we're really talking expanded universe, Star Wars still did it first.
Mm-hmm. And maybe even Star Trek before them, with the novels and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it. I don't need it. I'm not... I mean, I don't care. I don't care. I don't want people to be like, they should never do the Matrix again. Like, whatever. I'm not upset about it. I just...
You're not invested.
So, no, it's beyond not invested. I feel nothing. Like, it's just a cold deadness inside that only the absence of an afterlife can bring.
See, I don't think there's... And I don't think you're alone in that. I think our generation is kind of over it. I think the Matrix jumped the shark. And the Wachowskis have never really bounced back from it. I mean, they've had a few interesting things here or there. Some people like Sense8. Most people aren't watching it. Cloud Atlas was okay.
Yeah, I didn't... I liked Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, it was an interesting curiosity, but basically didn't really make any moves on the Richter scale beyond that. But Ascending was ridiculous.
Ugh, yeah, it was so woof.
I find even in their worst work, there's nooks and crannies of interesting ideas, and they're always, you know, dealing with ideas, and I think that they... are cerebral filmmakers, even if they're not always great filmmakers, but I don't think that's going to matter since they're not involved whatsoever at all. So, which means that what we're going to be getting from this is just the sort of McDonald's Happy Meal toy version of, you know, a reduced copy of the idea that they came up with in 1999.
And it'll probably be really bland and
super dated.
Mostly flash and very little substance.
Mm-hmm.
No one will care. It will do all right, but not well enough to really light anybody's panties on fire.
Mm-hmm. It's
and then,
probably
in
be...
10 more years, they'll relaunch The Matrix, and everyone will be like, oh man, The Matrix is good again! And it's like, fuck off with your fucking selves.
It's probably going to be a lot like the Colin Farrell reboot of Total Recall. Just a non-entity at this point.
I guess. So remember in the end of The Neverending Story 2, where there were these sort of, well, I guess it wasn't the end, but just sort of the plot where there were these nothing creatures. So the end of Neverending Story, the nothing attacks, right? Uh-huh. And then the second one, there's these nothing creatures, but they have these sort of like weird carapace, this weird like crab-like carapace that was hollow inside.
Mm-hmm.
That is what I am starting to develop when I hear about movie stories like this. Like, I used to just be the end of Neverending Story, but the amount of nothing I feel is soon going to develop its own manifestation which will march on Hollywood and raise it to the ground.
Why don't we get to talking about Kong?
All right.
Which is our the big review of the week, both big figuratively and metaphorically.
Oh,
and literally. Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe what happens in Kong Skull Island?
A team of scientists has decided to head up an expedition to explore this new island that was discovered in this... it takes place in the 70s, and due to satellite technology, a new island has been discovered in the Pacific Theater. It is just as Vietnam is wrapping up, and a scientific expedition gets a team of soldiers to go on one last mission to Skull Island to see what possibilities might be there. Turns out the scientists might know a little bit more about what's lurking in the jungle than the military signed up for. And as we know, that is a giant monkey.
Yes, as it says in the title of the film. And, because of circumstances, the team kind of ends up being split up on the island. And you have the military dudes being run by Samuel Jackson as their captain. He's kind of trying to rendezvous with the other team. It's a little bit more science heavy.
Yeah. Well, he's playing the Captain Ahab Flint character who says he's going back for the team, but really he wants... after their first encounter with Kong, he wants another crack at him.
Yeah, he has a vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big...
And then on the other team, you've got Tom Hiddleston's cheekbones.
Yes. And Brie Larson and John C. Reilly pops up in there, and John Goodman, and this is a pretty big cast.
That's funny you say John C. Reilly pops up there, because... really, it's his movie.
Kind of, huh?
I mean, he's basically the main character.
Well, I would argue, I would argue he's the only character. I think the rest of the cast, there's a lot of movie going on, but there isn't a ton of character and not a ton of story, which is actually not always a problem for this movie.
No. In fact, sometimes it probably works to its advantage.
Yeah. A lot of people were talking about when the promotional materials were being released, and the first Kong Skull Island poster that came out was kind of modeled after the Apocalypse Now poster, the original Apocalypse Now poster from the 70s with like Marlon Brando's face, and then you see like them on the river going down and everything. And so the Kong poster looked a lot like that. So people are like, ooh, are they going to be all Oliver Stoney and, or not Oliver Stone, Francis Ford Coppola and Dark and whatever? And I'm going to say no, mostly not, although there is some Vietnam stuff and a lot of like, Vietnam pop music playing in the background.
This is basically just a really high budget, schlocky monster movie.
Yeah, I was going to say that it resembles a little bit more like if Timur Bekmambetov had directed a remake of Anaconda.
Nobody got that reference.
Yes, I did. Timur Bekmambetov, the Russian director who did the Daylight Night Watch movies.
Oh, okay.
And
now I get it.
And Wanted. Which is to say that it is a big old schlocky monster movie. And actually, that's the stuff I like in it the most.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I think the movie could have pushed that a little harder. They definitely went for the safety of the PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that might have been a little out of place. And I don't know. I also think it was a little hard because, we were watching this coming off of Get Out, coming off of Logan.
Yeah, it was.
That did not pull their punches at all. And so, to me, it was like, why are they softening this? Like, it made me hungry for that, like, just rip-roaring, totally
R-rated ballsiness.
I miss that in movies.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't... I don't necessarily mean that this had to be like totally insanely dark, or and in fact, I think the tone is pretty right in the movie. I think maybe it could have been a little scarier.
Yeah, there's sort of a general sort of slickness or Hollywood gloss that doesn't never really lets you fully into a mood.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of went a little back and forth with this movie because I liked a lot of moves it made, but I kind of felt like this has sort of the same editing problem as Suicide Squad. Like, a lot of it felt sort of weirdly paced, and just like, you know, strange sort of trailery cuts.
Yeah,
that sort of took, I think, would lead to some cool, like, little juxtapositions and stuff, but overall left the tone feeling a little empty.
Yeah. Well, I'm back and forth with the emptiness because, Jordan Voight Roberts, I guess, directed this, who I'm not terribly familiar with, but the movie has, I would argue the movie sort of has a style in its commerciality. Yeah. Like, I feel like there's almost, and I think this is sort of what ultimately saves it from just being, you know, a King Kong version of like a Transformers movie or something, is that it has a self-awareness of the fact that it's a corporate entity and that it's basically this big, legendary, reboot thing. But I kind of feel like the director, he sort of knew that, and he sort of directed it almost like in that sort of Robert Rodriguez-y sort of way, where it's on a candy high and it's totally ridiculous, but it's also sort of, it's living within a movie world, not the real world.
Yeah, that's true. I definitely appreciated that. Like, the style was really well done, and the overall look of the movie was great. And
yeah, there's a lot of money shots of, you know, just ridiculous, hero shots of Kong in the sun and, like, you know.
Well, so a lot of this movie was filmed, obviously not on location because Skull Island is fictional, but a lot of it was filmed in, like, Vietnam and stuff.
Okay.
And I think that does lead to a lot of authenticity to, you know, to just some of the atmosphere this movie's building. And I think setting it in a different time period was a cool choice. My biggest problem with the movie is, and this is, I think, maybe where the PG-13 could have been pushed a little harder, was that, you mentioned we have this amazing cast. You know, we've got Johnny Goodman. We've got Samuel L. Jackson. We've got, Brie Larson. You know, we've got Tommy Hiddleston. We've got John C. Reilly. I don't know why I'm saying their names all weird. I was trying to do a thing. Ignore it. But, you know, it's got this amazing cast. And, you know, like, John Goodman has, like, two lines of dialogue. He, like, assembles this weird Avengers team of monkey hunters, and then that's it. Like, he could have just not been in the rest of the movie, and you literally wouldn't have made a difference.
Agreed.
And same with Tom Hiddleston. Like he was really only there for his cheekbones and how good he looks in a tight blue shirt holding a gun.
Right.
Like, he's doing nothing. You know, at least Samuel Jackson has this vendetta character. And we get a little bit of fun. I really liked the two soldier guys, like the old guy that's in every HBO show ever, sort of seasoned soldier, and the young black guy who played Eazy-E in Compton.
Right.
I really liked their dynamic. I wanted more of it. But so, you know, we have this bloated cast. And none of... Well, okay, this might get a little spoilery. But I don't feel like any of them are really in any danger, because the whole time there's all these other soldiers that are sort of this disposable monkey fodder. Mm-hmm. And it's like they don't even really show you how many soldiers are there during these establishing shots. But it seems like during some of the monster sequences, there just happens to be more soldiers. And it's like, come on, let's build some stakes here, because there was enough going on in this movie that I was like, so there's the scene with the skull walkers, right?
Which are like these giant
graveyard.
Yeah, these giant lizard things that also live on the island. Yeah.
And they're cool, and they're, you know, this creepy monster design, and there's like this weird fog, and there's this bones, and it's just a cool setup scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then the monster is supposed to devastate their crew at this point. Mm-hmm. But all it does is kill these sort of unnamed red shirts that we've never seen before. Like, flamethrower dude? Really? He couldn't have just been one of the soldiers that has had some lines of dialogue?
Right.
And so that's what bothers me. And that's a very modern thing to do, is like, let's have these disposable characters so that, you know, I don't know why. Like, let's kill off some of the main characters. Let's feel it a little bit, at least.
There's a few that get knocked off. Like, so there's a few characters you don't expect to die who do. And also, I would say that Kong shows up a lot earlier in the movie than I thought he would.
I think that was probably in direct response to some of the criticisms about the Godzilla reboot.
Yes, and I would say, although both movies suffer from a lot of the same things, I would say that this is, for me, more successful. It's more fun, and it doesn't take itself as seriously. And it, to me, I barely recall the Godzilla reboot. I saw it; it happened, but it didn't left zero impression on me. And
The Godzilla reboot didn't have John C. Reilly, who is such a good actor,
such a delight.
He, like I said, this is his movie. Like, mm-hmm. it is. And I think without his character's through line story, I would have enjoyed this movie a lot less.
Yeah, it ultimately comes down to whether or not you can give in to the stupidity of the movie. And by stupidity, I mean gleeful stupidity. Because I think that it is kind of enjoyably stupid. But it is dumb, and it's not a very good movie. But if you look at it as just a gigantic, over-budgeted, like, asylum sci-fi film, then it's actually, like, if it's Megalodon versus, you know, Croc-a-Shark or whatever, it's one of those, but done with a, you know, three-digit million-dollar budget.
Yeah, it is building to Kong versus Godzilla eventually, which I'm excited for that. Like, that's going to be, I want it to be as fun as Freddy versus Jason. Like, I remember when we went and saw that, and that's not a good movie, but it's a lot of fun.
Right. You know? Yeah.
I want it to be a movie monster boxing match.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that in this movie. I like the look of the movie. I kind of like the tone and the style sometimes. Samuel Jackson's turned all the way up. His dial's turned to 11. John C. Reilly, at least you have him to kind of anchor you into some sort of semblance of story. There's not a lot of characters besides him, and the plot is sort of video gamey, and that it's just sort of, okay, we're moving up this track, and now nothing's happening. We need another monster beat. Nothing's happening again. We better introduce another monster, because there's a lot of them in this movie. And I like the monster designs. Mm-hmm. Besides just Kong and the giant lizards, there's, you know, giant bugs, weird little, like, bat lizard things that are kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a strong influence from the success of Jurassic World on this, but whereas that movie I kind of hated, I feel like this sort of like tonally gets that B movie thing even more than that movie did.
I agree. Like, I mean, and I think the scene that sort of clued me in on exactly what type of movie this was, was the giant spider attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, all right, I get this. Okay, I don't need to worry about some of these other things like plot and character.
Yeah, there's even kind of a Harryhausen-y feel to it, like a Journey to the Center of the Earth kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it was a lot of fun. It frustrated me because I feel like I feel like there is a better cut of the movie, or
maybe
had they just made some more ballsy choices, I think it could have been just even better, you know. But yeah, if you know what you're getting into, is just like, you know, schlocky matinee, which John Goodman was in the movie Matinee. I think the biggest crime, though, is just wasting the talent of the cast.
Yeah, like, definitely. Especially to have such a big star-studded thing and to not do anything with almost all of them.
Yeah. Except John C. Reilly, somehow, is the one that, like, sort mm-hmm. of rose to the top. But he's so fucking good.
Mm-hmm. It's also a little front-loaded, I feel like. Like, there's a lot of leading up to them just going to the island, which, knowing where it's headed, retrospectively, I'm kind of like, oh, that was all a bunch of nothing. Like, you could have just, like, started with them in the helicarriers on their way to Skull Island and be like, yeah, the war just ended, and we have to go to this thing. I don't know. Especially as many of those characters ended up not really doing anything in the movie, but...
Yeah, and that's exactly what I mean. Like, I think that was part of the editing and just general pacing issues that always just sort of kept me a little bit out of it.
Yeah, I would say that's fair. If we're doing grades, I'm feeling a C+ on this.
All right. I was going to give it a B-.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not great, but I had a really good time watching it, so.
Right. Cool. Well, let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework then with Dirty Mary Crazy Larry, which I assigned you last week.
Did you rewatch it?
I've never seen it before.
Oh.
I had always meant to, so that is why I assigned it.
Oh, I thought this was one of those ones that you were like, I'm going to make him watch this.
No, this wasn't movie torture. Although it might have ended up being that inadvertently. So, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry is directed by John Huff. This came out in 1974. Peter Fonda is a star as Larry. Susan George plays Mary. Larry is a would-be race car driver who's trying to get this perfect car built, but he can't afford it because it's the 70s and it's, you know, your heroes have to be villains. And he is going to pull off this big heist, trying to take this money and blackmail these people or ransom, as it were. And he has to hit the road and he's hightailing it from the police, but along comes his floozy from the night before, Mary, played by Susan George, who is kind of tagging along, and she wants to prove that she can be just as good of a bad guy as he is. And then they have their friend, played by Adam Rourke, Deke, who's kind of their one-man pit team to kind of work on the car whenever they, you know, drive through a fence or something and they have to fix something on the go. Yeah. And then it's kind of just an episodic car chase movie where they're running away from the police and they're being hightailed, and every once in a while they'll like stop at a bar or they'll stop and fix something in a barn, and it's paced awkwardly, I would say, because it's of that time in the 70s. It's not exactly an exploitation film.
Was there ever a movie that was more 70s than this movie?
Oh, sure, yeah. But, I mean, this definitely sits really well. I mean, this is part of that whole kind of, like, convoy era, and, like, you know, there were, and, like, Smokey and the Bandit, and there was a lot of these kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. And this one's
this was back when they could sell a movie based on the car stunts in the trailer.
Right, yeah. And I originally heard of this movie, or was made aware of this movie by Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, when it comes up in a line of dialogue, along with a big list of other 70s car chase movies, so I knew that it was something of an influence on that. And you can see that, especially the backroads car chases. I can't say that it's essential. I feel like it is a product of its time. It's a curiosity of sort of the exploitation era, but it's not... It's mostly not good.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I had mixed feelings about it. Like, I liked... I don't know. It was just so 70s. I don't know. I basically found both Larry and Mary to be pretty insufferable.
Yeah, I think that was... I mean, and like I said, in the 70s, there were a lot of movies about bad guys as your heroes. And, like, you know, certainly, like, somebody like Travis Bickle is not, like, a good character as far as being, like, a likable person, but you're totally entranced in his worldview the whole time you're watching Taxi Driver. That never really happens here.
But, yeah, I mean, Larry and Mary, also, their names are obnoxious.
Sure.
But they're just kind of obnoxious themselves. Like, they're just kind of... whiny brats.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we don't really get a really great sense of why Mary has just, like, decided to run off with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she clearly barely gets along with Larry.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna see how many times I can rhyme their names.
Mary with Larry.
yeah, and again, they're just kind of insufferable. And they kind of make... by the end of the movie, show that, you know, maybe Peter Fonda isn't the kind of guy we should be rooting for. Like,
yeah.
But really, I loved Deke.
Yeah, he was a great character. And the best performance, I think, in the movie as well.
Yeah. And there's, he actually sort of kind of grounds Mary at the end there, because there's a
mm-hmm.
there's a moment where they're talking about ditching Larry, because they sort of realize that he's just a bad guy, like, you know, he's right. Not an anti-hero, he is just like just garbage person.
And I was entertained by, like, the idea, like, they've already, like, knocked four police off the road into, like, ponds and bridges and whatever, and yeah, they've, you know, they've
Hazard style, like,
very, yeah, and they've been on, everyone knows who they're on the police radio, they're on, you know, they're being pursued on television, all this stuff, and Larry's still talking about, like, when I get my car built, and I'm like, no, you're going to jail. Like, that is where this ends. Like, even if you could somehow escape this, which, of course, you're not going to, even if there'd be no way you were going to have some sort of professional life as a public figure.
No, and also, it's kind of funny because they see him do all of this terrible stuff, and then when he acts terribly towards Mary, they're, like, surprised by it. Like, mm-hmm. he hits her at one point. And, I, you know, I am not condoning violence against women at all. In fact, you know, this is sort of our clue that he is actually just a pretty deplorable guy. I just don't get why they're surprised by it. I mean...
Right, yeah.
You know, everybody's treated Mary like garbage except Deke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's just... Yeah, like you said, I think it's just sort of a little oddity. It's kind of a piece of its time. The car chases are pretty fun, but they're a little too few and far between for me.
Yeah, I kind of expected by, you know, the point of reference I had and everything going into it, that would be more of what the movie was. And there was a lot more kind of, like, stopping and waiting and that kind of stuff. And you mentioned, like, Mary and Larry being kind of annoying and the banter between them. I kind of feel like there's a little bit of this that wants to be, like, a screwball comedy between the two of them, and it never really does that.
Yeah, it also is, like, trying to toe the line sort of between, like, sort of a bandit love story, like Bonnie and Clyde.
Sure.
And, but also this sort of, like, adventure story, but also they're bad guys, which, I mean, Bonnie and Clyde are bad guys, too, but
yeah.
they're their relationship, their romance is sort of the crux of those characters, whereas this, we're just sort of seeing them fight all the time and hate each other and always try to ditch each other and outsmart each other, which was sort of fun, but I don't know if it was entirely self-aware.
No, well, you know, this was probably made on the cheap and made very quickly. I'm sure there, you know, the script had been mulled over a little bit. But I, you know, given the, all the different objectives it had tonally, where it wanted to be like an action adventure movie, it wanted to be a, you know, a car chase movie, it also kind of wanted to deal with this idea of like an unlikable character and like sort of flipping the script on which character we're supposed to root for. And then also kind of being an effective screwball comedy between the two in sort of this like, I don't know, His Girl Friday sort of way. There's not enough time or money or preparation to any of those details for all of that to ever gel as one singular thing, which when you're talking about cheap, almost exploitation movies of the 70s, that's sort of always the case, is there's a untetheredness that people sort of are attracted to. That's why a lot of these movies become cult films.
But I also think that there is something about, I think there's something about the dialogue that is so like 70s slang that it comes off as a little detached. So maybe that, you know, maybe that played a little bit better in 1974.
Yeah.
Like the part where they're spelling insults at each other, but they're like these sort of 70s insults that I was like,
yeah, I mean, some of that is probably just because it dates, but I think the generally speaking, the dialogue is just clunky. Because there's movies, even exploitation movies I've seen from the same era. You know, any Jack Hill movie I think has better dialogue than this, and they're usually made for half the price. I just think generally speaking, the script just isn't very good.
I don't think it's the story itself.
It holds together as a story, but.
Yeah, but there was a lot I actually did enjoy from this. Like, I thought the sheriff character was pretty fun. I also thought Deke was fun. Some of the car chases were, you know, pretty cool. The end car chase with the cop that I thought kind of looked like a weird sort of frumpy 1970s Channing Tatum, where he's like chasing them, screaming, you know, homophobic slurs because of the length of his hair. I'm like, oh, that's so 70s. But the chase scene itself was I think pretty well done. And yeah, like if you're watching it from that perspective, I sort of get it. Like, you know, this is kind of the Fast and the Furious of the 70s. I mean, obviously not as successful or franchisable, but you know, sort of the precursor of the hot girls, hot cars kind of thing.
Yeah, and well, I mean, we were talking, there was kind of a lot of films. The original Gone in 60 Seconds and this film, and there were a lot of like car chase movies in the 70s, but even Fast and the Furious was a remake of a Roger Corman film from the 50s.
I didn't know that.
It is in a long line of tradition of sort of exploitation, you know,
genre. They remade Gone in 60 Seconds. They remade Fast and Furious. Maybe we're due for our Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry remake.
You know, actually, I was thinking about that while watching this. I think it was Steven Soderbergh who said in his keynote speech to some college, when he was complaining about the state of Hollywood and, you know, bloated, franchisable, blah, blah, blah. And he said, like, I don't understand what the deal is with all these remakes. Why remake great films that we love? What they should be doing is going back and finding these programmers that had a good idea in it, but weren't able to totally pull it off. And this is exactly the perfect candidate for that.
Yeah.
I would have no problem with if somebody wanted to remake this. I think there's enough of a IP identity in it to, like, you know, bank on that. But yeah, I think I see, like, the germ of something okay in this. I mean, even, I like a lot of cult films, and I like a lot of exploitation movies, and To me, it's not idiosyncratic enough to, like, go into, like, absurdity, and it's not action-oriented enough to really just enjoy it on a genre level, and it's not funny enough to really enjoy it on a comedy level. So to me, it just kind of lives in this weird, nebulous blah of a 70s programmer.
Yeah, I agree. I think maybe if they remade it as, like, sort of a dark comedy, could be, a lot of fun. I mostly just thought it was kind of boring through a lot of it. Like, it's been way too long fixing the fucking car at the barn. And,
right.
It's getting a new car. And not enough time, hauling ass on the road. You know, they try to sort of have these character moments, but they're just kind of boring.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's why I said largely it doesn't work. The only
exception is Adam Rourke as Deke, who I'm a little bummed out. I didn't see more Adam Rourke stuff. I feel like.
More Rourke.
Yeah.
I would say
give it to Gosling.
If there's a movie you want to see, like if you're on Netflix and you're flipping around and you're like, oh, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry is going to be this fun exploitation thing, and it'll be dumb and fun and whatever, and I can eat my pizza. I would say, I don't think it's on Netflix, but instead of watching this, just watch Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, because that's what you really want to see.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it. Do you have anything to assign me next week?
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it or not, so this is a shot in the dark. Since you're going old school on me, I'm going to go old school on you and make you watch the 4-hour epic Cleopatra starring Elizabeth Taylor from 1963.
Are you for real?
Yeah.
You really want to do this?
Well, okay, so actually Ashley wants to do this. And she's been bugging me for the last couple ones, and I'm like, I don't know. It's like 4 hours long. But
you could pretend it's an HBO miniseries and watch an hour a day.
Yeah. No, we're doing it.
You're going to binge it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that's your homework. We're doing it.
Okay, I've never seen Cleopatra. We can do it. Sure. I mean, this along with My Fair Lady is responsible for killing the golden age of Hollywood. So there's a conversation there.
You know, it's funny. She actually almost made you want to watch My Fair Lady. So that might happen at some point as well.
All right. And that's the end of the show. I don't have my show notes with me because that's on my laptop that I'm not using. So I'll let you kind of go first. Where can people find you?
People can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. People can check out my show Tonight in San Diego. You can check it out at tonightinsandiego.com. We post videos there periodically, show clips, full episodes. You can watch it on the CW6 at Saturdays at 11. If you'd like to come to a live taping, we have live tapings every Monday at 7:30. Doors open 7:30, show starts at 8. It's like Conan O'Brien or Jimmy Fallon, but with a San Diego spin on it.
And less famous people.
I wasn't going to go there, but since you did, yes. Much less famous people, but I like to think that we're still pretty funny.
Right. And did you say, yeah, you said your Twitter and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You can also follow Tonight in San Diego on Twitter and, Instagram and all that stuff. And we also give away free shit at shows all the time. Like musical guests give out free CDs. They give out free vinyls. Some guests give out free sunglasses.
Cool. Let's see if I can do this off the top of my head. You can follow me at BC Cassidy. You can follow the show at Jabber Podcast on Twitter. You can find the show's archives in the RSS feed at jabberthedrone.podbean.com. We are available on Stitcher, iTunes, Player.fm, Google Play, the Windows Podcast Network. There might have been another one. All your podcatchers. And, oh, this is a... Do you know this whole, like, tripod thing going on right now?
Oh, yeah. I I heard about that on WTF with Mark Maron.
Yeah, so this month is apparently the month where we're supposed to promote other shows that we like, or promote ourselves, or have our fans promote us. That would be preferable. But I'll go ahead and say the obvious ones that we talk about every week. The Listening Party with Rod Denise, which I think our episode is still the most recent one. So you should go listen to that. Mm-hmm. And also Patrick, who's been on the show a lot, at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational.
Did he have any letters from our Logan review?
You know what? I forgot to check our email. So sorry, Patrick. If you sent something in the last couple days, I'll have to look it up on my desktop computer and read it next week. But as far as other podcasts, I just want to say stuff that I watch or stuff that I listen to that I like. I would also recommend Save It for the Show, which I talked about a little bit on The Listening Party when we were on there. I think they're totally consistent, great, very casual, hangouty sort of comedy podcast. Just two dads talking about like being in their 30s and whatever. And then The Sewers of Paris is one that I've been listening to for a while. It's about the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. One of the movie podcasts that probably influenced me the most, Linoleum Knife, but done by two LA film critics, one of which I took a couple classes from and got to know a little bit when I was working at the Wrap. But yeah, they've been doing a really good job for a really long time, and they're always hilarious. Dave and Alonzo over at Linoleum Knife.
You said they're hilarious, and I don't need that reference in my head.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, I'm just saying there's a lot of competition out there for what we do. So what if you're gonna tripod, what would you recommend out there besides us?
Yeah, I mean, all the podcasts I listen to do not need any help promotion from me.
If you
even heard of podcasts, you probably listen to these. I listen to the comedy ones. I like WTF with Maron.
Sure.
I only like it based off kind of who his guests are.
I think that's everybody.
Made It Weird with Pete Holmes. Mm-hmm. I've given Petey Holmes a few shout outs and I haven't, my phone hasn't been ringing. I just barely got into My Brother and Me, which is delightful. I wanted to not get into it.
It's just great. I remember, like, at the height of my podcast listening, mm-hmm. That's when I was driving for Key Med.
Oh, okay.
And they were almost too funny because I would, like, in the winter especially, like, laugh too much and, like, actually swerve and stuff. They would get me laughing so much I would be out of breath.
Yeah.
And it's not like they're even trying. They're not professional comedians. It's just their natural banter and the way they play off of each other is just hilarious. And I know they have this TV show now, which I haven't watched.
And that's kind of what got me into them, was I watched an episode of that someone I know posted on Facebook. It was just like a clip. And I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is really funny. I should check this out. So I've listened to a few episodes since. Mm-hmm. Those are my main ones right now. I also like Crime Town. I don't like to get too dark into the true crime stuff because it affects my dreams.
Right, right.
So I know there's some good ones out there that you can check out, like Sword and Scale and Last Podcast on the Left. And there's another one I'm forgetting the name of. I don't really listen to those a lot though because sometimes they give me the heebie-jeebies.
I'm okay with that. Maybe I'll start listening.
Yeah, I think you'd really like Last Podcast on the Left. There's another one that I like better, but I can't remember the name of it. It's the two girls. Oh, My Favorite Murder.
Okay, well, there you go. Those are podcasts that we listen to, and we will talk to you next week.
Give it to Gosling. Bye. More Rourke.